Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Sarah Anderson of the Institute for Policy Studies, who summarizes her group's report detailing the bribes and threats they claim are being employed by the White House to win international backing for its war on Iraq. John Bonifaz, lead attorney in the lawsuit Doe versus Bush, who describes the court case which is attempting to derail President Bush's plan for a U.S. invasion of Iraq by asserting that only Congress has the right to declare war. And Jason Hagan of the Washington Office on Latin America, who discusses prospects for increased U.S. military intervention in Colombia after three Americans working for the Pentagon were taken prisoner when their plane crashed in the jungle there. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
While the White House and its so-called coalition of the willing gear up for another attack on Iraq, major U.S. media outlets are sharpening their censorship pencils. According to Robert Fisk, a Middle East correspondent for the British-based independent newspaper, CNN, the cable news network, has instituted new procedures for editing and script approval at its Atlanta headquarters to further sanitize the network's news reporting from the Gulf War zone. In essence, it will be up to CNN management and not the reporters in Kuwait, Baghdad, or Ramallah who will make the final cut in the news accounts of what is happening in the new war on Iraq. During the clashes last year in the occupied Palestinian territories, the CNN bosses in Atlanta pulled off the air a story about Red Crescent ambulance drivers who were being shot at by Israeli soldiers. The objection in Atlanta was that the Israeli army would not comment on camera. As Fisk complains, since when do we hold a story hostage to the whims of governments and armies? This means that governments and armies are indirectly censoring us, and we are playing directly into their hands. The news magazine In These Times reports that the streets of Jakarta, Indonesia, were filled with protesters throughout January, angered over higher energy prices mandated by the International Monetary Fund. The protests, which faded after several weeks, expressed widespread resentment over President Megawati Sukarnoputri's economic reforms that led to higher fuel and telephone rates. The daily street protests reminded many of the militant wave of dissent in 1998 that drove authoritarian President Suharto out of office. IMF critics are now focusing in on the 2004 election and how Sukarnoputri's free market program has helped reduce average earning power more than 30% since the 1997 Asian economic collapse. The elimination of subsidies for Indonesia's energy and telecom rates won the endorsement of World Bank donor nations and the Asian Development Bank, which have given the Indonesian government $2.7 billion in new loans. Now, activists are demanding that Indonesia pull out of the IMF loan program. As Mulyandari, a women's advocate in Jakarta, observed, "We all know the IMF just works to keep the investments of international capital in Indonesia safe." In the early 1970s, civil rights activists in Charlotte, North Carolina, won a major victory for school equity when the U.S. Supreme Court approved busing and race-conscious districting to achieve student diversity. In many ways, the case changed the face of American education and made racial integration a hallmark of public education. But 30 years later, that progress has been reversed. A recent report by Gary Orfield of the Civil Rights Project at Harvard University reveals that over 70% of black and Latino students go predominantly to minority schools. According to the news magazine In These Times, 45 school districts, mostly in the South, have been declared by the courts as unitary, essentially desegregated, and court orders have been rescinded. Now the trend is toward resegregation. In the American South, integration hit its peak in 1988 when 44% of black students went to mostly white schools. By 1998, the percentage had fallen to 33%. In 1999, the historic Charlotte decision was overturned in a lawsuit by white parents seeking neighborhood schools. Given that neighborhoods in Charlotte and elsewhere are racially and ethnically divided, resegregation became the expected outcome. The irony is that school integration was starting to work, argues University of North Carolina professor Rosalind Mickelson. Academic test scores were rising for black and white students. But with resegregation, Mickelson predicts a new wave of racial antagonism and growing racial gaps in school achievement. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.
As the United Nations Security Council prepared to vote on a U.S.-British resolution that would authorize war against Iraq, the Bush administration was working furiously to win over the required 9 votes they need for passage of the motion. Employing its levers of economic and military aid, the U.S. has placed enormous pressure on the so-called Middle Six countries, now serving as non-permanent members of the Security Council, whose votes are seen as pivotal. These nations, Guinea, Cameroon, Angola, Mexico, Chile, and Pakistan, have not only been subjected to promises of billions of dollars of reward and threats of punishment, but they apparently have also been the targets of U.S. espionage. A report in the London Observer newspaper, based on a leaked document, details how American spy agencies have monitored communications at these countries' UN offices in hopes of gaining an edge in their campaign to twist arms. Although Turkey was promised a package of grants and loans from Washington worth $15 billion, that nation's parliament failed to approve a deal to base some 62,000 U.S. soldiers on their territory from which an invasion could be launched on northern Iraq. The White House continues to work for a second vote on the measure. The Institute for Policy Studies recently published a report which examines the instruments of pressure being brought to bear on members of the UN Security Council and other countries the Bush administration is trying to recruit to support its war on Baghdad. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Sarah Anderson, director of the Institute's Global Economy Project and a co-author of the report titled Coalition of the Willing or Coalition of the Coerced. She summarizes the bribes and threats her group says have been employed by the White House to get its way.
Well, lots of people have been saying that this is just politics as usual, and of course it's true that there's nothing brand new here. I do think, though, that the level of intensity is greater. We're really seeing the mother of all diplomatic wars here, and the reason for that is because public opposition around the world to this war is so high. And so that's why our U.S. officials are out there having to really hustle and work harder to try to get countries to support their position. But of course, there are precedents for this in the past. Back in 1990, when they had the UN Security Council vote to authorize the first Gulf War, there was similar bribery and arm twisting. And one of the clearest examples was with Yemen. Yemen was the only Arab country on the Security Council at that time. It dared to vote against the U.S. resolution. And no sooner had the Yemen ambassador to the UN sort of pulled down his hand after voting no, then a U.S. official came over and told him, that will be the most expensive no vote you have ever cast. And within 3 days, U.S. aid to Yemen was cut off. And it's a country that's, you know, very poverty-stricken and really felt that blow. So, you know, that stands as an example to a lot of other countries right now. There are 3 very poor African countries, for example, on the council that would not like to see their aid cut off from the United States. And so that's one way to sort of intimidate countries.
The other countries, the so-called Middle Six, the countries whose vote is being sought by the United States include Guinea, Cameroon, Angola, Mexico, Chile, and Pakistan. Maybe you could talk about where the United States is likely to succeed and where it's likely to fail and the levers being brought against some of these other countries.
Well, it's really unclear at this moment. I have to tell you, it's just been high drama for the past week watching things go back and forth. With Mexico, it's a very interesting case. Here's a country that is completely dependent on the U.S. economy. Over 80% of their exports go to the United States. President Fox of Mexico has worked very hard to try to have a good relationship with President Bush. You know, they get together in their cowboy boots on their respective ranches and so forth. He's also tried very hard to get some concessions from the U.S. around immigration issues. And he is really having the screws put to him right now. The U.S. ambassador to Mexico was quoted in the Washington Post saying basically that if Mexico votes no, they can expect big trouble from the U.S. government when it comes to matters of concern for Mexico. Right after that, President Fox appeared to shift his position somewhat. He'd been very outspoken against the U.S. position, but that he started to kind of waver. Then there was a bit of a backlash. You know, Mexico is a very proud country. They don't like being told that they have to do whatever the U.S. says. And so now he appears to be, you know, shifting back to opposition. And it's really been like that all week. I also want to point out, because it was huge news this weekend, although it hasn't been picked up much by the U.S. press yet, but the London Observer, which is quite a reputable paper, printed a blockbuster story which was based on a memo leaked to them, which was a U.S. government memo, which laid out a plan for spying on the six countries that you mentioned, the swing countries on the council, to wiretap the phones of the U.N. ambassadors from these countries, both their office and their home phones. And it's just, I think, an outrageous action that this is how they're treating countries that are supposed to be our allies. You know, it's not enough that they have so much power to twist arms and to, you know, wheel and deal, but they're having to play these dirty tricks at the same time.
What, in your view, is the long-term damage to U.S. credibility throughout this whole process, even if the United States gets its way with a vote in the United Nations Security Council to authorize war?
Well, you know, if they can buy off support by offering, you know, Turkey $30 billion or whatever, well, the next time that the U.S. wants to put together one of these sort of phony coalitions, countries will hold out until they can, you know, get bought off. So it'll just become more and more expensive every time, you know, we want to have a coalition effort around anything, I think. I mean, why wouldn't countries hold out for big money once they've seen that kind of a precedent? And I think it's a very ugly situation. This is not at all how to go about tackling issues that really are of concern to the whole world. I think it's really important for the American public to know that this is a sham, and that the U.S. government is trying to hoodwink them into thinking that this is about multilateralism, and it's really not. And I also, you know, maybe this is a secondary matter, but if they're out there offering Turkey, say, $30 billion to go along with this plan, that's U.S. taxpayer money, and we should care about how that's being spent.
That was Sarah Anderson of the Institute for Policy Studies. Contact IPS by calling area code 202-234-9382 or read a copy of their Coalition of the Willing or Coalition of the Coerced report online at www.ips-dc.org. Americans who are opposed to war in Iraq have been protesting in unprecedented numbers over the past several months across the nation in big cities and small towns. They have paid for ads in newspapers and on TV. Massive phone and email campaigns to congressional representatives have also been organized. Recently, a group of active duty soldiers, parents of men and women serving in the military, and 12 members of Congress have filed a lawsuit to stop the war. The suit is known as Doe versus Bush to protect the identities of those currently on active duty in various branches of the military. Plaintiffs in the case include members of Congress John Conyers of Michigan and Dennis Kucinich of Ohio. The lawsuit maintains that only Congress can declare war, and therefore President Bush cannot legally wage war in Iraq without such a declaration. The suit was dismissed last week on February 24th by a judge in Boston who ruled that the judiciary has no power to intervene in matters of foreign policy except in cases where Congress and the president are strongly and clearly in conflict. The plaintiffs immediately appealed and were granted an expedited hearing before a three-judge panel on March 4th. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with John Bonifaz, lead attorney in the suit. He explains the basis of the court action, the differences between this effort and similar suits filed during the Vietnam War, and places in context the congressional resolution of last October giving the president the power to use force against Iraq.
The president has been all over the country saying, "I'll decide whether or not we're going to wage war." It's not his decision to make. And Congress did not have the authority under the Constitution to transfer that power for making this momentous decision onto the president. It and only it can make that decision. Congress can't pass on to the president the power to levy taxes. Congress can't pass on to the president the power to appropriate money. Congress can't pass on to the president the decision of whether or not to send this nation into war. There are certain powers that are non-delegable. They are only powers of the United States Congress. And we clearly would not accept if Congress had passed a resolution transferring to the Supreme Court the decision of whether or not to go to war. So why would we somehow accept it if it's transferred to the president? The president is not a king. He cannot wage war against another country without congressional approval. And this is precisely what the framers of the Constitution intended, to ensure that these presidents of the United States would not be like European monarchs of the past, who could send their subjects off to war on their own volition. The judiciary must intervene to protect and uphold the Constitution. This is not a political question. This is, in fact, the very essence of what courts must do, to interpret what the branches of government have done and to ensure the Constitution is being upheld.
So if you win on appeal, that would mean that the judge or the panel would rule that President Bush cannot go to war without going back to Congress and get an actual declaration of war. Is that correct?
The president will be under a court order effectively preventing him from waging war absent a congressional declaration of war. I don't doubt for a moment that the U.S. Department of Justice, which is representing President Bush and Defense Secretary Rumsfeld in this case, would immediately seek a stay of that order and try to get the Supreme Court to overturn it. But again, we are determined to aggressively fight for upholding the Constitution on behalf of our plaintiffs and on behalf of all similarly situated people in this country and around the world. This is going to be an illegal and unconstitutional war without congressional approval. And we cannot go down the road which we went down during Vietnam, where the country was not behind the war. And that was because the process had not been followed. Now, it is true that cases were brought during the Vietnam War similar to this. But unlike this, though those cases were brought in the middle of the war, toward the end of the war, and by the time they had been brought, Congress had acquiesced via military appropriations to finance that war, via draft legislation. Here we do not have any military appropriations. We do not have any kind of mandatory military draft. All we have is a resolution Congress passed last October, which ceded to the president unlawfully the decision to send this nation off to war, ceded it to him to make. And you know, the reason why we require that Congress deliberate, that Congress debate, that Congress make this decision is about accountability. It's about democracy. Because if the people of this country do not want to go to war, then they ought to know that their members of Congress are voting a certain way. And if the members of Congress are going to vote with the president, then they should be held accountable on election day the next time they're up for election. And that's what a democracy is about.
Now, it's also, I guess, fairly possible that by the time there would be a ruling, we could already be at war. Would that change anything? I mean, there would still be this legal decision, but would it be kind of moot?
No, we don't believe it will be moot at all. We believe that any legal and unconstitutional action needs to be stopped. And if we were at war without a congressional declaration of war, then the court would simply have to rule that it's an illegal and unconstitutional war and prevent the president from continuing the war until he gets a congressional declaration. I think it's quite significant that members of the military, U.S. soldiers, one of whom is a United States Marine based in the Gulf, are suing the president of the United States on the grounds that he does not have the authority to wage war absent a congressional declaration of war. I think the fact is that there are other members of the military who quietly agree with them. We've gotten feedback from them as well. And I think that this is what is indicative of what happens when you do not have a clear debate, deliberation, and vote by the United States Congress on whether or not to send this nation to war. And the fact that three U.S. soldiers have the strength and the courage to stand up to this president in this particular climate of fear and tell him that he needs to follow the dictate of the Constitution is a proud moment for the American military.
That was John Bonifaz, lead attorney in the lawsuit Doe versus Bush. A ruling is not expected until after March 11th. For more information, contact Military Families Speak Out at 617-522-9323 or visit their website at www.mfso.org. While the U.S. has poured more than $2 billion into combating drug cultivation and guerrilla groups in Colombia, the war being waged by hardline President Alvaro Uribe has taken a deadly turn. Assassinations of human rights and union activists are escalating at the same time that the nation's largest rebel group, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, or FARC, has launched a series of deadly urban bomb attacks. More recently, the crash of a plane carrying U.S. citizens working for the Pentagon and the capture of three of them by FARC guerrillas in the Colombian jungle has triggered the insertion of 49 more American soldiers and advisors to the area sent to free the captives. In a reminder that oil politics is not confined to the Middle East, the White House recently formed a special battalion under U.S. command to protect a Colombian pipeline owned by the U.S.-based Occidental Oil Company. The Bush administration clearly is in accord with President Uribe's stated goal of abandoning negotiations with rebels in favor of attaining a military solution to Colombia's four-decade-long civil war. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Jason Hagan of the Washington Office on Latin America, who discusses the White House pursuit of a military victory in Colombia and the prospects for increased U.S. military intervention there.
The embassy has not been very forthcoming about what the nature of the mission was and who the individuals were. There have been rumors that they're DEA agents, CIA agents, that they were military contractors. It's unclear, but we do know that they were flying in the southern part of the country over the coca-growing regions, and the plane crashed, and evidently one Colombian was killed, one American was killed, and three Americans are being held captive, supposedly by the FARC. And this was frankly inevitable. Given the number of Americans who are down there who are flying these types of missions, this was bound to happen.
How many Americans are there?
There are caps. There is a cap on 400 military personnel and 400 contractors. However, for example, now we've gone beyond that cap because there is a clause in U.S. legislation which permits us to exceed that cap in the case of search and rescue operations. So we know that we've gone beyond that limit right now because at least 50 troops were sent recently.
So what are the dangers here in terms of the capture of these U.S. citizens, not knowing if they're military or intelligence or what have you, but what are you most concerned about at this moment?
The concern is getting sucked into something that we're not really fully aware of and that we don't understand. Very few people in Congress, if anyone, is really aware of the immensity of how much work will require to win this militarily. And unfortunately, when Americans are held captive or when they're killed, Congress reacts very swiftly and sometimes without thinking. And our concern is that they will start providing more and more assistance to the Colombian military. We'll get more deeply involved, and before you know it, we'll be in over our heads in a conflict that is not winnable and that will involve U.S. troops.
Maybe you could talk to us about President Uribe, who took office in Colombia, promising a stepped-up war against the guerrillas, a military defeat, and what that has meant on the ground for average Colombians and the safety and security in that nation's major cities.
Yeah. President Uribe has taken three primary measures to establish what he calls democratic security in the country. The first are the creation of two special zones called zones of rehabilitation and consolidation. One of them is in Arauca province, where the United States now is protecting an oil pipeline that is operated by Occidental Petroleum. And in fact, in that very province, we've seen violence escalate. It's become the most dangerous part of the country. And this, again, is a place that it was supposed to be a model. It was supposed to be a showcase for how the Colombian military can pacify the country. The second measure that Uribe has taken is the creation of a 1-million-person informant network, in which unidentified individuals will be provided radios and will communicate with the police and the military if they spot any suspicious activity. And the third has to do with the creation of part-time soldiers called peasant soldiers. And they will be serving precisely in the municipalities or counties where there is no police presence currently. And they will act as soldiers during the day, and at night they will return and spend the evenings home with their families. And this concerns us because they become easy targets for any of the warring factions, and they will actually be exposing their families to reprisals as well.
Do you want to mention the urban terrorism that has been recently launched by FARC with the bombing of an athletic club in downtown Bogota, killing a number of citizens there?
A couple of weeks ago, there was a car bomb set off in Nogal, which is the most exclusive club in Bogota. The entry fee just to gain admittance is $15,000. And for a place like Colombia, this is an astronomical sum. 70% of Colombians make less than $2 a day. So this was a real attack at the heart of the elite. It stunned the city. It stunned the upper classes. And it does show that the FARC are not only more sophisticated with their bombing techniques, but they have a greater presence in the city. And they're willing to take these types of actions in the cities. When the drug traffickers did this in the early 90s, it really paralyzed the nation. And the Colombian government essentially gave up trying to extradite the drug traffickers. They couldn't match the bombings in the cities. And the concern is that the FARC now will do the same. And eventually the government will have to yield. They can't put up with that for too long.
Jason Hagan, what are the prospects for increased U.S. aid, increased U.S. military intervention in Colombia, and the scrutiny that the Bush administration policy in Colombia is getting from Democrats and legislators in Congress?
Right now, I know at least a number of Democratic representatives wanted to have a good debate this summer, this spring, on Colombia policy. Plan Colombia has been in effect for a few years, and yet we haven't seen any positive results thus far. So some people really want to step back and reevaluate the U.S. position towards Colombia. At the same time, something as silly and trivial, really, as the capture of these three Americans can really prevent that debate from ever happening. And we could just see kind of a reactionary response, more military assistance, again, without really understanding the nature of the conflict and the complexities of the conflict. And the fact is that this war is not going to be won on the battlefield. There will ultimately have to be peace negotiations. Everyone recognizes that. We're just concerned that there will be thousands of people dead after several years of conflict before anybody realizes that fully.
Now, you say silly and trivial. I mean, there are people listening to other captured Americans out there, but maybe you could just explain further what you mean in terms of the context of the greater decades-long conflict.
Right, in the sense that there are 3,000 kidnappings every year. And there are all but three of them every year are by Colombians, and yet nobody bats an eyelash. And the large scope of things, if you look at the conflict and the fact that this has been going on for decades, the fact is that three Americans should not be enough to change U.S. relationship with Colombia. But like I said, it just might happen.
That was Jason Hagan of the Washington Office on Latin America. Contact the group by calling area code 202-797-2171 or visit their website at www.wola.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Denise Manzari, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Sasha Summer-Cousineau.